Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Thursday morning. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org in Phoenix, along with Phil Latzman. I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, the Arizona Coyotes are staying in the West Valley for now, and the Arizona Republic's publisher moves into academia. But first...
Well, recently, KJZZ published a series of stories on health care in the Arizona prison system, and one of those stories caught the ear of a federal judge, and he's announced plans to investigate the allegations made in KJZZ's original reporting. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins has been reporting this series for us. And Jimmy, while the stories of poor health care and even inmate deaths are so tragic, tell us about some of the most compelling voices in your piece that we heard. It was Jan Watson. Tell us a little bit about her.
Sure. She's a medical doctor. She was an OBGYN for most of her life. She lives in the Valley, and now she's practicing medicine part-time. And one of those part-time contracts she recently worked was in a state prison. While she was there, she saw things that made her feel that the state's private health care provider, Corizon, was acting inappropriately.
And Jimmy, we've reported on the relationship between Corizon and the state extensively. What's the main issue here with their compliance with the contract?
The judge has said this repeatedly. The plaintiff's attorneys have said it. And now Jan is with her testimony. The main driver behind all this is there aren't enough doctors in the prisons. Jan told us she and her staff were constantly overworked and just completely overwhelmed with all the requests for medical attention. So Jan actually quit her job and she came to us because she thought that what she had seen was wrong and she wanted to get the story out.
So people always ask about whistleblowers. Why didn't they go through an internal process? Did this person make any efforts to address her problems to the company?
Oh, totally. If you go to our website, you can see that Jan was a huge lobbyist for her patients. She wrote countless emails, some of which we published, where she essentially is begging for more resources, equipment, medicine. And as to an internal complaint, she alleges in her story that her direct supervisor told her to let a patient die. So she had no confidence that any internal system would address her concerns. Also, we heard in court yesterday for the first time on record that the judge overseeing the settlement process gets calls to his chamber all the time from people like Jan. And he said they tell him, quote, it is so much worse than you think.
And Jimmy, pretty wild scene in court yesterday. Tell us about the judge's reaction to the reporting that the station has done that you've done.
It was stunning. I was sitting in the back row for this, and I was just totally floored. When the judge comes into court, he usually says, you may be seated. When he came in yesterday morning, this is Magistrate Judge David Duncan at the federal courthouse downtown. He said, you may take a seat if you wish. And he remained standing. And he said, I am literally standing this morning because I'm standing up for the rights of inmates in Arizona prisons. And he pulled out an iPad with our story on it. He quoted from it in this rising and booming voice for like 15 minutes. He called Jan's emails what we published, a potential smoking gun. And he said Corizon was obviously trying to pull a, quote, end run around the monitoring process. So Judge Duncan called for a special hearing on February 9th to investigate Jan's claims, as well as to see if the judge believes he can trust any of the internal monitoring that Corizon is doing. The judge said he may appoint an independent monitor in the settlement, which would be paid for by fines levied on Corizon for their failure to meet the very standards being investigated.
Oh, fantastic reporting, Jimmy. In this series, you also reported on problems with inmates with chronic disease getting treatment. Why is it so hard for these prisoners to see a doctor?
Well, ADC and Corizon say it's three things. Doctors don't want inmates in their waiting rooms, they don't have the capacity, and they pay access rates, so they don't think that they, you know, make enough money off of them. But the judge in this case has remarked often that Corizon doesn't have enough of its own doctors working in the clinics in the first place. He said that they've clearly just paying fines instead of employing more doctors to save money. So then you need off-site treatment. That means working with a hospital or a clinic or other private provider. But this can be a real challenge for several reasons, not limited to the fact that Corizon is known to be slow paying its bills. Assistant ADC Director Richard Pratt has testified that Corizon was slow to pay a major healthcare provider. That provider actually had to send letters asking for payment. So this means other providers are less likely to want to work with Corizon. We also learned yesterday that a major Corizon oncology subcontractor has declared bankruptcy, leading to an even larger backlog of cancer patients in Arizona. So it's just been a systemic and ongoing failure.
So Jimmy, assess for us whether there's any chance of these problems actually getting resolved, even with what the judge said.
Well, the fines Corizon was paying for low staffing levels were capped, But as of November, those caps were lifted, so the company could be facing hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines each month. Also, the judge has hired at ADC's expense a firm to help Corizon study and resolve their troubles finding doctors to work with. And this is a really huge development, this hearing on February 9th. Jan Watson will take the stand, and her story will be heard in federal court. And the judge said he could end up appointing an independent monitor, which could change the whole scope of the case. And guys, I think it's just important to emphasize that Jan had nothing to gain by doing this. She's come forward to stand up for the patients that she worked with in the prisons, and she's created real change.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins with some real impactful reporting. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, guys.
Arizona Senator Jeff Flake says Republican leadership has promised to let him bring a bill to fix DACA to the Senate floor next month, and Congress currently has about 75 days to act before the official phase-out of the program starts. Joined now by KJZZ's Matthew Casey, who's been following the story. Matt, good morning, and how did we get here?
Good morning, Steve. So at the beginning of this month, Flake put out a statement saying he would back the tax reform bill for two reasons. The first was to get rid of a so-called budget gimmick worth about $85 billion, and the second was the chance to work on a DACA bill with Senate leadership and the Trump administration.
And Flake said yesterday he's already negotiating with fellow lawmakers, and let's just say the bill is a go in the Senate. Does Flake think it can pass the House of Representatives and the president will actually sign it?
So the president has previously said that he wants to help DACA recipients. And Flake said he's already getting input from the White House. But he knows it will take a bipartisan effort to get it through both the Senate and the House. Flake said during yesterday's news conference that the Senate might be able to tie it to other legislation.
I hope that we can put it on a must-pass spending bill. That's the easiest way. But if not, I'm convinced that the House will do it.
Matt, this question might have seemed impossible even a month ago, but could this turn into comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, Steve, you know, anything is possible, but Flake really seemed to doubt it could happen all at once. We know lawmakers are working on the scope of the bill right now, and as far as DACA, researchers said a couple months ago that there were about 690,000 people enrolled in the program, including roughly 28,000 in Arizona.
But there's also a broader population, kids who are eligible but haven't registered. That could be, you know, over 2 million.
Matt, did Flake say if the bill will give Dreamers a chance at citizenship?
Earlier this fall, Flake introduced a different bill that did include a path to citizenship. And he's also used the words permanent protections in a previous statement about this bill. So I think he supports Dreamers becoming citizens. But listen closely to how he ended his answer to that question yesterday.
Any long-term fix contemplates citizenship for these kids, not necessarily their parents, but for the kids, certainly.
Flake's use of the word contemplates was kind of vague, but that could be because he knows citizenship may be a really tough sell for some members of Congress who are up for re-election, and he'll need to earn at least some of their support for a DACA bill to make it to the president's desk.
KJZZ's Matthew Casey with the latest on DACA. Matt, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
The on-ice struggles for the Arizona Coyotes continue as the team has the worst record in the National Hockey League, and the organization's future home also remains in flux. But that part of the equation has been settled, at least for next season. The city of Glendale and the Coyotes have agreed the team will play at least one more year at Gila River Arena. And with me to talk about the details is Mike Sunix of the Phoenix Business Journal. So, Mike, why are the Coyotes remaining in Glendale for the time being?
Well, the Coyotes don't really have any other place to go. There's no new arena deal here in the Phoenix market, you know, for them to turn to. The downtown Phoenix with the Suns doesn't seem to be happening. The Suns seem more interested in renovating their own arena or building, having one on their own. They had a deal, Coyotes had a deal with ASU, they thought, in Tempe. That didn't happen. ASU really didn't want a part of that, and that needed some help from the legislature in terms of financing. And so there's nothing locally, you know, for them to turn to right now. So Glendale's the option here. Relocation-wise, which has come up a number of times about them going to Quebec or Seattle or Kansas City or Portland, you know, the NHL put a lot of effort and a lot of money into keeping them in Arizona in the Phoenix market. And so I don't know if the NHL's really interested in that, unless a big fish comes along with an arena say in Seattle, that could really offer a better deal. But Gary Bettman, the NHL commissioner, has put a lot of capital into keeping a team, you know, in the Phoenix market, which is a big ad market for the NHL to sell to sponsors and advertisers.
What does Glendale get out of this? Now, I know they need to have bookings at that arena without question, but is Glendale in a position to try to do something else, or without the Coyotes, would they be in real trouble again right now?
You know, that development out there, Westgate, next to the arena, you know, has really changed over the past couple of years. It's going to change even more. You've had the Outlet Mall come in there. Dave and Buster's come in there. IKEA and Top Golf are both locating new locations. Those are two very desirable retail tenants right out there by Westgate. And so a few years ago, there was really a lot of worries about, you know, the Coyotes are going to leave. It's going to be an empty arena. What do you do with this development next to it? All the places, the bars and restaurants, are dependent on the Coyotes and Cardinals for business. I think things have changed a little bit out there to where Westgate, the area itself, is a little more sustainable beyond the arena. Obviously, having, you know, 40 hockey games and the concerts helps, and losing the Coyotes would impact some of the restaurants and bars out there. But there's enough activity out there right now drawing people in, and they've drawn some office jobs out there. There's some call center type jobs at Westgate, so they're in a little better position. And I just think the Glendale mentality towards the arena and the Coyotes has changed. When it was first built, you had Elaine Scruggs, all those folks who had built the arena. They were invested in that arena. They didn't want to see the Coyotes leave in the end. And then you had Jerry Wyers and then another group come in, and they saw these arena deals that the city had done with the hockey team, and they said, well, that's a little excessive in terms of how much we're paying them to manage the arena to be located there. But I think now they're a little more in the middle. They say they'd like to see the Coyotes stay. I don't know if that's going to happen long term, but I think at least they can probably do these one-year deals with the team until something else comes along for the Coyotes arena-wise that kind of benefits both sides.
The perception could be that a lame duck status is not good for either side, but maybe they can make it work, huh?
Yeah, as long as the Coyotes don't have a better deal out there, a new arena in the works, that's going to take a while anyways. I mean, even if they had cut a deal with Tempe or are going to build something down here with the Suns, it's going to take a few years at least to build that thing and to get them down to a new location. So, you know, the one-year thing kind of works for a little while and stuff. So, and then you've got the Coyotes have new ownership. Andrew Barraway bought out the rest of the owners. Got a new team president. You know, new coach. And so I think all those folks over there are still getting their feet wet and running the show. And so they've kind of maybe recreated the wheel a little bit in terms of, hey, where are we going to be located? What are we doing with the arena? Who are we going to work with? And so they got a new regime over there. And that probably helps keep them in Glendale a little bit longer.
All right. Mike Sunnix of the Phoenix Business Journal. Mike, always good to talk with you, and happy holidays.
Oh yeah. Thanks for having me, Steve. Always appreciate it.
It's the show here on KJZZ, and the question today is, will they or won't they? That's floating on Capitol Hill as the deadline looms for Congress to fund federal agencies with a budget or face a government shutdown at midnight tonight. Demands have been made on both sides of the aisle. Pass a DACA bill, shore up health care markets, fund CHIP. But as midnight nears, it looks like some of those lines in the sand are blowing away, and the next best option might be for Congress to punt funding decisions in 2018. We should say that deadline is tomorrow at midnight. And one reporter watching the playmaking going on behind the scenes is Eric Wagner, who is a reporter with the Government Executive, part of Atlantic Media. And the show's Steve Goldstein asked him about one funding option on the table, one the Dems deemed Puntagon.
Puntagon was a plan that House Republicans floated last week, and the idea was that they would fund the Defense Department for the full fiscal year, that's till the end of September, but then they would only fund non-defense spending, domestic spending, until January 19th. And it was a derisive term from House and Senate Democrats who want parity between the defense and non-defense side.
Now, tomorrow, December 22nd, is a huge date. Is there a continuing resolution on the table? Would it be something that by the end of today or sometime on Friday, there could be something that extends another month, another few weeks?
There is a new resolution that the House Rules Committee is going over right now that just does a clean four-week CR along with some money for community health centers and a reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Program through March and some things like that that they are, I think, a little bit more hopeful will garner enough support to make it through.
Now, considering Republicans have both the Senate and the House, what are Democrats hoping for? What's the best outcome for them in terms of what they're trying to get negotiated in?
Well, they have a number of wish list items that they're trying to get some combination of in the final bill. They had wanted to get a full fiscal year CR that raised the spending caps across government equally, but that seems like it'll be punted to next month. House Democrats still hope to get some sort of provision of the DREAM Act in. That's the codification of the Obama administration program for undocumented immigrants who were brought to this country as children.
And some Republicans would like that too, even including Arizona's Jeff Flake. Is that something that could potentially be in play?
The tricky thing is the there are a lot of House Republicans who would not want to vote with that. So that seems like that's something that they will probably kick off till next month, but we'll see. Additionally, as I mentioned, chip reauthorization is a another bipartisan priority, and some Democrats want additional disaster funding for Puerto Rico and Florida and Texas. The Florida and Texas aspect is bipartisan as well, but Democrats are hoping to get more for Puerto Rico as well and the Virgin Islands.
Now, as you mentioned, there is a difference in opinion among some House Republicans and some Senate Republicans. So it's not just the Democrats who are getting involved here. Are Senate Republicans basically on the same page, though? It's just where the House comes in, they disagree?
It's the House that's really the big stumbling block when it comes to the Republican caucus. The House Freedom Caucus in particular frequently looks for spending offsets whenever there are agreements to increase spending on the non-defense side. So they want cuts to other programs to help pay for any discretionary spending.
How much of this is political calculus from your point of view?
Well, the way I see it is there's political calculus that goes on in any decision that happens on Capitol Hill. The question is, you know, what's going on here, I think, is that, you know, everyone takes into consideration the potential ramifications of a shutdown. However, this ends up being sort of the main vehicle, especially for the minority party, where you have leverage to actually see some of your policy goals implemented.
Now, we've talked about the politics of it. What about the real people on the ground, the government workers? Are we talking about potential, if in fact there is not a settlement? We're talking about having have to have potential furloughs and that kind of thing.
Sure. So the Office of Personnel Management, which is sort of the federal government's HR department, has been instructing all of the federal agencies over the past several weeks to come up with, you know, their shutdown plans. And that includes an idea of like how many people would be furloughed, how many people would be deemed essential. So if midnight tomorrow night comes and there's no deal, agencies will inform all federal workers whether to come in on Monday or whether not to. And people who are required to come in, you know, TSA agents, correctional officers, things like that, they will be required to work without pay until Congress comes to a deal to reopen the government and get it funded. But
if, in fact, something does get settled, even if it's something that's just a couple of weeks or a month, are we going to see members of Congress running to the airport to get home for Christmas?
Probably, yes.
Okay. Eric Wagner is a staff correspondent for Government Executive. Eric, thanks. Good to talk with you.
Thanks, you too.
It's the show on this Thursday. And with Steve Goldstein and the Takeaway's Todd Zwillick, this morning I'm Phil Latzman. The European Union's highest court came down hard on Uber this week. It ruled that the app-based ride-hailing service should be regulated like any other taxi provider across the European Union.
Now, Uber has fought for a long time to be treated by governments like a digital platform only, just an app that connects people who like to drive to people who need rides. And that identity, just an app, lets Uber avoid most of the responsibilities and liabilities and regulations of a traditional taxi or transportation business. Well, no longer, at least not in the EU. Meanwhile, Uber has seen similar fights all across America. Arun Sundarajan is an expert on that kind of model and these fights that are going on with ride sharing. Arun, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Arun, let's talk about this EU ruling first. What did the EU say to Uber, and what does it mean for drivers and for riders there?
So this was an anticipated ruling from the EU. In deciding whether Uber was a digital platform or a transportation service, they came down on the side that Uber is a transportation service, just like a traditional taxi service or a black car service. What this means is that all Uber drivers will have to be professional drivers. In all likelihood, Uber's relationship with its drivers will have to change from contractors to them being full-time employees. And so it dramatically changes Uber's cost structure if it wants to operate in different European cities.
If Uber wants to operate in Paris or Utrecht, you can no longer just say, hey, person with a Toyota and an app, drive and get some money. You have to treat them like a person with a job, with benefits and a pension and everything else.
I think the specifics of exactly how Uber drivers need to be treated are going to vary city to city. Like in the United States, across Europe, transportation is regulated at the local level. But it certainly sort of raises the bar for Uber because it's a business that has tried to bring in sort of casual labor to shore up supply shortages, like, you know, during rush hours. It's tried a wide variety of UberX-like services in many European cities, and these have already been shut down. What worries me more about this decision is that I think Uber is going to find a way around it. They've got the scale, they've got the demand, they've got the financial resources. For a smaller startup that's trying to enter a new European city, the barriers have just become a lot higher.
So it gets tougher for smaller players. But does this mean in the bottom line that the virtues of the gig economy, the sort of the cheap labor that was available in the Uber model, is not going to be allowed in Europe, at least not in the way that, that Uber had hoped?
Well, I don't think that it's going to be allowed for transportation services. I believe that this ruling will spill over to other gig economy or on-demand services like delivery on demand, hiring people through an app. So it's certainly going to place a lot of barriers on platforms that offer these kinds of services and are currently using contract labor.
So let's come back to the United States then, because Uber, and it's just one service, although it's the biggest, the most high profile, it's been going into city after city, community after community in the United States. And it seems like every time they do, they wind up disrupting, maybe a good thing, but they wind up in a confrontation of some kind, either with local transportation services, which makes sense, or with the local economy. Give us a couple of examples of how Uber's been sort of confronting the different cities that it's gone into.
I think that every city that Uber has entered in the United States has led to some kind of confrontation early on. One of the early success stories was actually New York City. There was early confrontation, a ban back in 2012, but they very quickly came to agreement with the Taxi and Limousine Commission and found that middle ground between transportation service and digital platform. The city came up with regulations tailored for Uber. Uber complied with them. This contrasts with, say, Oregon, except for Portland. Uber is banned across the state of Oregon right now because they haven't been able to find that middle ground. I think that the service itself poses challenges because it flies in the face of what we're used to. But I think Uber's personality in the past as a pugilist rather than as a pacifier has also been partly responsible for the level of regulatory confrontation that we've seen them engaged in.
Now, Uber has relished this confrontation. I live in Washington, D.C. Certainly, there was a high-profile confrontation that Uber seemed to be enjoying when they came to town.
That was certainly Uber's personality in the past. I've seen a dramatic change in that over the last few weeks that their new CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, has taken over, where he's trying to reposition Uber as a sort of a compliant partner who is worthy of the public trust rather than a disruptive Silicon Valley platform that breaks all the rules.
And this decision in the EU, is it likely to solidify that new attitude? I mean, there's a danger here maybe that big American cities and their city councils may take the cue from the European Union and say, no, 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 we want you to be a taxi company.
Well, I'm sure that there will be some thinking in municipal governments in the United States sort of reflecting on the structures that they've come up with. But labor law in the U.S. is fundamentally different from labor law in the European Union. We're far more open to the independent contractor model here than cities in the European Union are. And so while I expect some reflection, I think we should also recognize that many American cities have spent many years coming up with the right regulatory structure that recognizes this new middle ground that exists between a hands-off digital platform that is unregulated and the traditional sort of taxi service with full-time employees.
Arun Sundarugan is a professor at NYU. He was talking with Takeaway's Todd Zwillick. Across the United States, invasive species are threatening sacred lands in which Indian tribes rely on to live. However, when it comes to discussing how to combat these invasives, Native Americans are often left out of the conversation. So why are indigenous peoples being excluded, and what knowledge might they be able to impart to help fight the problem of invasive species? There are more than 56 million acres of Native American lands nationwide, and many of them are feeling the effects of the encroachment of invasive species. But as it turns out, there's a lot we may be able to learn from this threat by blending ecological and anthropological methodologies. Joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Nicholas Rio. He's assistant professor of Native American Environmental Studies at Dartmouth College. He's also a citizen of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians. So, Dr. Rio, first of all, how are these tribal lands being affected by these invasives, and especially here in the Southwest?
Yeah, so the focus of the paper wasn't on impacts per se, but the impacts are certainly a significant concern. And, there's a lot of different facets. So there's a lot of different layers, and a lot of it's regional. So thinking about the southwestern United States, where you're based, a lot of issues have to do with, connected issues of drought. So, you know, the Southwest is in general a dry region, and it's been drier, in recent years, and certain, introduced plant species can exacerbate those water shortages. And so we heard quite a bit from respondents from the tribes in the Southwest about plant species that exacerbate drought for the spaces within their reservations that hold water. They're impacted by plants such as salt cedar and others. Russian olive is another one that came up several times.
Your study is not necessarily about the impacts, though. It's really about why tribal nations are being neglected when it comes to invasive species work. And explain why.
Well, I think there's two parts. That's kind of a two-part response. And one is that on the ground, they're not always ignored. They're oftentimes working very collaboratively with other governmental partners, state, provincial, federal, local governments, as well as NGOs. So on the ground, they are oftentimes working collaboratively with their neighbors. Sometimes they're left out of processes, or they're invited too late to a regional approach to invasive species. That definitely occurs, but they're involved. I think the bigger issue that we're trying to address is that they're just not noticed and described in the literature. So where scientists are reporting what's going on with invasive species management and ecology, tribes are sort of left out of that literature. And I think it's basically a symptom of a broader issue of tribes and indigenous peoples sort of being relatively ignored within sort of conservation and in ecological literatures generally.
One of the things you point out in your research is that some new methods, relatively new methods of pest control, you know, using chemicals are avoided by tribes because they don't believe in chemicals. They don't want to do harm to other lands and farmland, which they rely on for their everyday food.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's increasingly, you know, broadly speaking, beyond indigenous communities, there's increasingly a recognition that there's limits to the utility of chemical-based approaches and using pesticides and herbicides. Sometimes agencies and organizations find it to be the only effective measure or a necessary risk. But for indigenous communities, the risks are different because their people are actively touching, harvesting, engaging with plant and animal materials that are out in the environment at a higher level than the general public. And so, tribes and First Nations and other indigenous groups are oftentimes reluctant to spray chemicals because their people are out in the wetlands and in the forests and in the prairies a lot gathering. That's not to say that they never use chemical approaches because they do, but they're more hesitant.
And you mentioned that a lot of these Native American tribes and indigenous peoples are using their own old methods of fighting these invasive species. And a lot of them, as you've talked about and we've seen in some of your studies, have worked. So what can we learn, maybe going back to nature, from some of these tribes?
You know, some of these plants and animals are being incorporated into people's food systems or medicine traditions. Some of them have other utility, like for heating homes or for, you know, building products or compost or that sort of thing. And so, and it's not just indigenous nations that are thinking in this way. Others are as well. But I think it's really helpful. It's to just, rather than just to react and say, okay, this, we need to combat this, is to say, okay, let's really think carefully about what our options are moving forward, in a more holistic sense. The other thing that I'll add is that just the idea of having a longer vision, thinking in longer timescales. So thinking about a longer a lot of indigenous groups talk about seven generations planning, like thinking seven generations behind us and ahead of us when we're making decisions about land management or other issues. And I think that perspective can be really helpful in thinking about the new introduced species as well.
Nicholas Rio is Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies and Native American Studies at Dartmouth University. Thank you so much, Professor. Very interesting.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Phil Latzman, along with KJZZ's Mark Brody.
There's a change coming at the top at the Arizona Republic. Publisher Mia Parrish is leaving to take a position at ASU's Cronkite School. She took the job at the Republic in 2015 after working in editorial positions at a number of newspapers across the country. And she joins me to talk about her pending job change. And Mia, what led to your decision to take this new position?
I've been thinking about it for a long time. I mean, the business has been in incredible transformation, and what I love about what I've been able to do is to be a strategic innovator in a very disrupted industry. And I have loved that, and I've been proud of that, but I also started as a journalist. And so I'm also really purpose-driven and mission-driven, and the opportunity to work with the next generation of innovators and entrepreneurs to help really reimagine and innovate the news industry, not just newspapers, is exciting for me.
Is it fair to say that some of the changes in your industry, in the newspaper industry, in journalism, maybe more broadly, sort of pushed you from it into something else?
It helped really crystallize why I would want to go where I'm going, to be a part of figuring this out on a larger scale.
To a journalism school as opposed to another newspaper or another media organization.
Right, or to this journalism school, frankly. You know, I mean, there are lots of places to go, but it's the most innovative school in America 3 years in a row. And what I love is innovation, leadership, integrated partnerships. I mean, this sort of strategic thinking is really exciting to me, to be able to work with brain scientists and people who are working on missions to Mars with NASA and partnering with Facebook and Starbucks and Adidas. And I mean, all the things that are happening that I can't do from where I am. And to be able to partner and strategize and innovate, be entrepreneurial and teach that next generation how to do that and help us solve it is exciting to me.
You mentioned that you'd been thinking about this for a little while, and you've been at the Republic for just a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I mean, were you thinking that this might be something that you wanted to do even before you came back to Phoenix?
Academia itself? It's always been an option. You know, I love coaching, I love leading, I love teaching, I love collaborating, but I wouldn't do it just anywhere, and I wouldn't do it just for anyone. So this is when the opportunity came up, and it was a perfect fit. You know, it's a media innovation and leadership chair, right? I mean, it's sort of like, hello, universe.
I mean, do you think that you were able to achieve at the Republic what you wanted to, given that you're only there for a couple of years?
I got a lot done in 2 years, and I'm proud of what I've gotten done. And it was a very transformational, very interesting, challenging, inspirational time. I mean, really, like, what we've been able to accomplish in that amount of time and in that time period, you know, I think I will miss it, and I wasn't done yet, per se, but this is when the opportunity is, and I feel like, you know, I got a lot of stuff done, you know, and I'm proud of it, and I'm proud of the people I got to work with.
So all things being equal, it sounds like you maybe would have liked to stay in your current job for a little longer and then maybe move to academia a little bit later?
I don't know. No, I really feel like now's the right time. I do. And I think there's a lot of transition coming. The kind of job that I was hired to do 2 years ago isn't going to look like this going forward. And I'm really, really good at what I was hired to do 2 years ago. And I'm really, really good at what I'm going to be doing. So that's exciting to me.
Do you think that the kind of coaching and teaching that you will be doing at ASU, was that not something that you were able to do at the Republic?
I think there's coaching, there's teaching, there's inspiring, there's leading, and those are all things that I'm able to do. But I think the kind of partnering that I can do at ASU is really exciting to me. I don't get to work with brain scientists today, right? You know, I don't get to work with...
Most of us don't.
Right, exactly. You know, rocket scientists and people who work on consumer behavior and do research on the type of work that's being done in algorithms. And they have a blockchain institute. You know, what does blockchain mean, that technology for trust and transparency for advertising and news? I get to work with those people. You know, I don't get to do that right now. So that's exciting to me.
What do you think the Arizona Republic will look like in 5 years, do you think?
You know, I've made a lot of predictions over my life. You know, I don't know, 5 years. You know, it won't look the same. Technology won't look the same. Technology won't look the same a year from now. And we'll, you know, hopefully continue to be nimble. They'll continue to be innovative. Because I've said all along, I'm agnostic about how people read us. I just think it's really important that they do. And we've never been more important. Journalism's never been more important. So whatever it looks like isn't as important as that, you know, you're there and you're relevant and that you're there to hold the powerful accountable and give voice to the voiceless and entertain and empower and educate and sometimes amuse. But whatever it looks like, whether it's, you know, it's ink on paper or it's pixels on screens or it's on the back of your eyeballs, you know, it's who knows.
All right. Mia, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you.
Mia Parrish is publisher of the Arizona Republic. She'll be leaving that position early next month to become the inaugural Sue Clark Johnson Professor in Media Innovation and Leadership at ASU's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Mi nombre es Natividad Gutierrez y hoy estoy haciendo tamal.
And my name is Alex Gutierrez and I'm Natividad's son.
40 años tengo haciendo tamales.
My mom says she's been making tamales for about 40 years and she loves it because it's from Mexican tradition. Voy a tener que poner
Sí, la tradición es de Christmas para ti.
So mom says that, yes, they're a tradition for Christmas and New Year.
Muchos regalos y doy regalos.
And they're actually kind of like little presents, my mom says, that she hands out to family members, friends.
Ay, ay, ay.
She also likes to like see people's faces when they actually have them because she says that she feels beautiful knowing that they love them.
Sí.
That's Natividad Gutierrez making tamales with her son Alex at home. And if you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or taste like Phoenix or smell like Phoenix, send us a note at the show at kjzz.org. Well, we see them in forests around Arizona. And when it comes to wild horses, KJZZ's Tom Maxedon reports that people hold varied views on how to best protect such iconic images of the American West.
When you watch the opening credits of one of TV's longest-running shows, Bonanza, it's hard to miss the other stars, the horses. Of course, there's the Lone Ranger and all those John Wayne films.
Get down off them horses. I don't favor looking up to the likes of you.
And cars.
Even though Mustang is a dream, its low price is a beautiful reality.
And pop music devoted to horses. They are certainly iconic creatures galloping through the creative ether of pop culture, but why do they conjure up such a sense of Americana?
You're talking about an animal that is stoic and graceful and quiet, unless it needs to not be, and then it can do that at a moment's notice. And to me, that's kind of America.
That's Adam Eggers, spokesman for the Bureau of Land Management Office in Arizona. By contrast to other Southwest or Western states, Arizona doesn't have a lot of wild horse herds. BLM's primary focus centers on habitat preservation, but horse control on BML lands does redound on his agency.
It's a challenging mission to complete, and it's not something that we can do with just one tool. You know, we need a golf bag full of multiple tools.
One of those tools is the Florence Wild Horse and Burro Training and Holding Facility. It's the proving ground for a forward-thinking rehabilitation program, allowing inmates from the Florence Correctional Center to train wild horses caught on BLM lands.
You know, our horse populations are pretty small, and they're pretty stable. They tend to not increase like we have in other states. You know, Nevada, Wyoming, Utah, those are the states that really have a lot of horses.
That's John Hall. He's the Arizona Wild Horses and Burro Lead for BLM and the facility manager in Florence for the Inmate Rehabilitation Program, which trains horses for sale to the general public.
It's mostly a vocational skill, and it serves as a great rehab program. I mean, it's been recognized that having these prisoners work with these untouched animals is advantageous for both. It gives them a sense of being and accomplishment when they actually are able to get that animal fully trained and into the hands of the public.
Away from the Florence complex 4 days a week, Hall occupies a small office cubicle in a downtown Phoenix high-rise building far from where you would expect to find him.
I would still love to be in the field, and I do get to be in Florence at least one day a week. When I'm there, I try to be working the animals as much as I possibly can, right beside the prisoners, helping them prep or whatever needs to be done.
South Dakota rancher and wild horse expert Alan Day thinks one of the solutions to managing wild horses in the West is via public-private partnerships.
The government has done a lot of things to take regular government functions and put them into private management, and with some real good results. And so I have suggested that some conservation groups be entrusted to manage some of the wild horse areas, and I think would show private management can do.
To Day's point, there are smaller 501c3 charitable organizations and refuges trying to care for wild horses in Arizona, like Wild Horse Ranch Rescue in Gilbert.
This pretty mare with the blonde mane, she's a BLM Roundup. And then Stormy, the one in the middle, he's a stray from McNary. We have a res horse named Chip over there, and then a thoroughbred.
That's Kim Maher. She's founder of Charity at the Ranch that cares for and trains about 35 horses. None of the workers, including herself, makes a penny for their hard work. She says one of the reasons why wild horses are even an issue is because of cattle grazing on public lands.
Cattlemen are making a ton of money on beef. And these guys, if there are 15,000 horses on BLM lands and there are 6 million cattle, the cattlemen are claiming the horses are using up their resources. Well, math tells you that's not true. So the horses just don't, their value is not equal to slaughter of cows.
Maher prefers the horses be set free.
I just think the government should leave them alone. Why are they spending money to round them up and then care for them in, you know, holding pens?
There are no easy answers for how to best preserve wild horses and who should pay to do so. BLM and nonprofits have slim budgets. Private ranchers have to make a living. Until the greater public acts on the issue, the fate of wild horses remains uncertain. Tom Maxedon, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It's the show, along with Steve Goldstein. I'm Phil Latzman.
We all have our favorite movies, films that touched our hearts or blew our minds. These are the movies we show to our friends and family as the best movies ever. And chances are one of your favorite movies might be in the National Film Registry. The registry is part of the Library of Congress, and the movies they pick are earmarked for preservation. Each year, thousands of films are considered, but only 25 are picked at a time. This year, we'll see the inclusion of Spartacus.
I'm Spartacus!
I'm Spartacus!
The Goonies. Die Hard.
Happy trails, Hans.
And Field of Dreams.
Ray. People will come, Ray.
But just how do movies get picked and why? Steve Leggett, the program coordinator for National Film Preservation Board, explains.
The criteria are culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant, which of course can mean almost anything, so we kind of like those broad guidelines. But it was intended to be films which have had an impact on American culture and history.
Beyond just Hollywood movies, the Preservation Board considers all kinds of films, including home movies or actuality films, which are like really early documentaries. This year, for example, they added a 1905 black-and-white video that shows off a then-new section of the New York City subway.
We try to make sure that, you know, they're documentary films, actuality films, films from different regions of the country. So just really try to make it a snapshot of the United States each year.
This year saw the inclusion of the first-ever superhero genre film.
God, look up there! What the hell is that?
Easy, miss. I've got you.
You've got me! Who's got you?
Richard Donner's Superman came out in 1978 and starred Christopher Reeve.
It really did kind of set the bar in terms of how you would do a superhero film, and in the special effects and just the whole of believing a man could fly.
And one of the earliest creepy clown movies was also picked in 1924. Audiences experience the thrill and terror of He Who Gets Slapped.
It's got Lon Chaney, who was in a lot of horror films of the silent era and early sound era. And it's a horror film, but it's also a psychological drama. He plays a scientist who has discovered a process, and he's about to reveal it, and someone else steals the information and steals his wife as well. So he's kind of down on his luck, and he becomes a clown in a circus. And one of the parts of his act is that the other clowns come up and start slapping him. It's kind of a really weird movie, and then eventually the person who stole his ideas appears in the audience, and then there's a lot of drama back and forth, and he basically unleashes lions on his tormentor at one point.
You can see all of the 2017 inductees by visiting our website, theshow.kjzz.org. We'll have the full list and links to the films. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.